70 in 7. A win today, Hockey O'Clock. Original.
Win today, Hockey O'Clock.
In diesem Augenblick wird's jetzt richtig hitzig. Yeah, und die Scheibe kollert über die Linie.
Nee. Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Das ist unglaublich, was die hier zelebrieren.
Nice move, hat er den Nice move.
Oh, it's gone. It doesn't get any better than this.
It's 70 in 7. It's the third week that we're blessed to talk about the great hockey life of the individual that's sitting opposite of me. It's, of course, player legend, coaching legend, a man who's dedicated his life to the great sport of hockey. He is Greg Holst. And coach, so glad that you're doing this once more. Two down, five to go. And the third part is about you from ages 21 to 30. These are indeed the meat on the bone parts of the series that we're doing about you. In what regard would you share or agree to that sentiment?
Well, the first two episodes, Mark, were brought back a lot of great memories when I was a child, going through university, the crazy, the fun times. But now going into my 20th year, that's my draft year. So now I finally figured out, oh, after having a meeting with Eagleson, which we will talk about, geez, I guess I do have a chance to play pro, and I probably have a chance at the NHL. So at 20 years old, that's when the next segment of the business really began.
How did that all come about? I mean, the draft didn't just pop up on your radar. You knew that it might happen. At what point was being drafted a possibility, and at what point did it become a reality?
Well, before I got drafted, it was the 74-75, and Allan Eagleson was the big agent back then. And I finished my junior year, and Eagleson got a hold of myself, my family, and flew me and my dad into Toronto. We sat down in his office and talked about what was coming up in the draft, what he had heard, where I was going to be probably picked. I was in the top three picks of three teams. So he said this to me, and we're probably looking at $100,000 a year for 3 years. We'll set up annuities where they break down the contract and pay you over a longer term. My eyes were like kind of wide open. I mean, Dad was with me, his too, because, you know, Dad had two jobs and to make ends meet. And here I am possibly going to make $100,000. So we left that office, and I'm pretty sure I said, hey, Dad, the beers are on me now. So we left. We flew back to Montreal. Then what happened? The Philadelphia Flyers won the Stanley Cup. The Broad Street Bullies. Fighting was a mega part of the game. And they won the cup. So now if we move ahead to the draft, is there a question you want to ask me right now?
There are so many questions that I want to ask you. And maybe just to backtrack a little bit, let's talk about Allan Eagleson, an interesting character, an agent, and an agent's usually have that kind of shady air to them that kind of surrounds them. And Allan Eagleson, he became notorious for something else later in his career, but how was dealing with him? And maybe you can also elaborate on what happened later in his career and other great players' careers.
Well, he's also the main point of putting together the 1972 Russia against the NHL. That series changed hockey in the world. He was influential and in the middle point of that. So for me to have Allan Eagleson as an agent, this was a big thing. because he was the agent back then with his associate, Billy Waters. So for me to sit in his office and hear him talk, how he spoke to me about top three picks, three teams, $100,000 a year, this was pretty freaking exciting. Like, my eyes are now wide open. What happened later on in his career, as it did with another agent who my brother-in-law was involved with, that's kind of, you know, if you're talking a fall from grace, this is right up there. And unfortunately, things changed later on in his career, but that's a completely other story.
Yeah, just to pay tribute at the very least to the early stages of his career, he's got his own Wikipedia page, and it says here, Eagleson's influence in the hockey world began when he negotiated Bobby Orr's first professional contract with the Boston Bruins. This led to the beginnings of agents in hockey. So we're talking about a true trailblazer in the truest sense of the word. He was your agent, and you got him leading up to the draft. So at that point, you knew there'd be interest. You knew you might be picked. But what happened in between you meeting Allan Eagleson for the first time, sitting in his office, and you eventually finding out that you were drafted? What happened in between?
Well, in between, the Philadelphia Flyers won the cup. Okay, so hockey had changed. It was fighting, was mega bench clearing brawls, dirty, tough. The Broad Street Bullies won the cup. Anyway, I didn't think anything of that because I could fight and survive. And, you know, I wasn't a heavyweight, but I could play and I could scrap and survive. I did it 4 years in the American League and in the minors. So now the draft comes, and back then it was in a hotel. They're going to do the first five rounds. It's not like it is now at the arena where everybody goes in. Eagleson flies me and my mom into the draft in Toronto. We go to the hotel. We have our room. So we're sitting in there, and they start going through the draft, all the guys that are his clients and some of his older players like the Bobby Orrs, the Sittlers, all those guys. Everybody's around. So the first round goes by. My name is not picked. The second round goes by. My name is not picked. Some of the guys that are going are a little bit surprising to me, but they may be more skilled and as good a player, but they were tough. They could fight. They could block shots. Round three goes by, not picked. Round four goes by, and round five goes by, and I'm not picked. That was the end of my stay in Toronto, because now the next day they continue with two. We do not stick around. So we were back on the plane, I'm sure next morning or that afternoon or evening. I think it was next day. I was not a happy camper. Basically thinking, I'm going to quit hockey. I got on the plane. I'm sure I had a couple of drinks. Mom probably tried to talk to me. I didn't have much to say. Don Cherry said, and I believe in Don Cherry, ex-Bruins coach, ex-player, commentator. He said, for all you young people, if you don't know, you're going to be a top pick. Do not go to the draft because you're going to be mega disappointed. Well, that's exactly what happened. I was mega disappointed. Kind of had a real chip on my shoulder, like I didn't give a shit. A couple days later, the Rangers phoned me. I got picked in the fifth round, whatever it was, or 139th pick, eighth round back then. And it's really funny because this is the New York Rangers phoning me. And I wasn't overly excited. But I said, okay, thank you very much. And then I said goodbye. See you at training camp. Didn't sign a contract. San Diego Gulls in the WHA also drafted me. They contacted me, or I'm not sure if they contacted me, but I was drafted to them also because both leagues were up and running. That is the disappointment of a 20-year-old who was not promised, but told highly likely, you're going to be a top three pick in three teams and make $100,000 a year. Well, boy, did that scenery ever change.
It's an interesting draft and an interesting time to revisit the 1974 NHL amateur draft. Now it's called the entry draft. The first five rounds were held in secret so that there could be no tampering by agents and other stuff. And there is an interesting bit on the 1974 amateur draft's Wikipedia page too. It says, as a statement of frustration at the slow, secretive conference call format, Buffalo general manager Punch Imlach claimed Taro Chuzimoto of the Tokyo Katanas of Japan using the 183rd overall pick. NHL officials immediately validated the selection, but weeks later, Imlach admitted that Chuzimoto was a fabrication. So he made up a player that he picked just to stick it to the higher-ups. Anything else that you remember from that draft apart from your frustration?
No, just, well, that's a funny story. I didn't know that story that you just mentioned. Not really, because Greg Jolly went first, as you had mentioned, and Rick Hampton went third, Wolf Paymal. These were all good hockey players. It just changed my view a little bit, because nothing against the other players, but some of the guys that I knew that got drafted in the first three, four rounds were not nearly as good hockey players as I was, but they had other elements, which was likely affected by Philadelphia winning the cup. So that I had to accept. I didn't really have a choice. Just getting back on the plane, the biggest thing I remember is, and I honestly remember thinking or even saying, I quit hockey. I remember saying that to myself at one point or out loud. So the biggest thing you take away from it, as exciting as it all was, it becomes a letdown and a mega disappointment. But that's part of life. That's part of sports, and that's part of life.
I got two more questions. One, about the phone call. And this phone call where draftees are getting told, hey, we're going to pick you and you're going to help us change the organization and you're going to be successful for a very long time. The usual blah, blah. But what from that phone call do you still remember up to this day?
Well, it was none of that blah, blah, where I'm going to change the team. A couple of those meetings came a couple of years later. It was just welcome to our organization type of thing. I can't remember exactly. Welcome to our organization. It's the New York Rangers. I'm not even sure who called me. If it was Emil Francis, the GM, or I can't remember. Probably one of the head scouts. Welcome to our organization. Look forward to seeing you at training camp. Have a good summer training. That's probably what it was. And I said, thank you very much. As excited as I should have been, I was not excited. And now I was going to have to go prove myself because I did not have a contract.
You were so close to quitting hockey. What made you revert on that? What made you go, Jesus, I can't quit hockey?
Well, I think the disappointment kind of sets you back and says, screw this stuff. You know, you get promised something and they take it away already. Okay, so let's get over that part. I'm going to go to training camp. I was probably working in the summer, had a job. But, you know, we trained hard all summer. We did our weights and we did our running and all our stuff we did. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to go to the Rangers camp and see how that goes. I don't remember ever saying, I got to prove them wrong. I just said, well, this is going to be pretty exciting because a few years earlier when I was going to Malcolm Campbell, before I moved to the West Island, I was probably 14 and a half or 15. I skipped school. I went downtown took the subway, and I met a team. I got autographs in one of the hotels. And do you know which team it was? It was the New York Rangers. I got Roger Bear's autograph, a bunch of the other guys. I remember Roger Bear extinct. I got a bunch of autographs. So now, 5 years later, I'm at training camp with these guys. What are the freaking chances of that?
Help me fill in the blanks. You get drafted, you go to training camp, but 74-75 season, you end up playing on the Winston-Salem Polar Bears and the Port Huron Flags. Why?
Okay, so we get to camp. Okay, but don't forget, I had no contract. So before you go to there, what's my contract? Do I have one? I am on the ice at training camp. But what's interesting, we get to the first meeting at the hotel, and a bunch of the pro guys that are on the team, the veterans, are standing around. And they were whispering loud enough that us rookies could hear. And I had a mustache. And they said, oh boy, when Emil Francis comes in here and sees the rookies with mustaches, he's going to freaking get so pissed off. I said, holy fuck. I went right up and shaved my stash off, as a couple other guys did. We came back down. The boys had a pretty good chuckle on that one. But anyway, I go to training camp. I'm on the ice, and I can play, and I know I can stick out, and I can score. And I guess you could say I'm doing pretty good. I'm freaking flying. All the scouts along the boards watching, and management, Emil Francis was also on the ice, the GM and the coach. Not even if I had a good practice and scored a couple goals, not one word was said to me. I have no contract. One day, Cap, I get in a fight on the ice. The guy was a little bit bigger than me, I remember, but I did okay. Held my own, had a good scrap. Emil Francis broke us up. When I came off the ice, that practice, all of a sudden, I started hearing, hey, good job, kid. Hey, Holston, good job. Good job. Good job. Ooh. So what did that mean? Because fighting was such a part of the game, are you afraid to fight? Can you survive? Can you scrap? Just the way it is, the way it was. And that is when they took notice that, okay, he can play. He can survive. And that's basically what happened.
I guess survival will be the name of the game, especially when we touch on your American Hockey League playing days. But just to give people an idea, how rough was hockey back then? I mean, when you're talking about survival, that sounds pretty serious.
Well, I'll tell you what, it wasn't much fun some nights. If you look over and, you know, we never got, I didn't wear a helmet for 2 years. But if you want to backtrack, do you want to backtrack to how I signed the contract? Because after that scrap where they started noticing me more now, Eagleson and Billy Waters did get a hold of the Rangers because San Diego was going to sign me in the WHA. And I think that was going to happen, according to the agents, within a day or two. So the Rangers had to either go, okay, we better sign this kid or we're going to lose him to the WHA. So I got a 3-year contract. My first year of the contract was, I believe it was $45,000 in New York, $17,500 in the American League, and $9,000 in the International League or in the Southern League. I had a 3-way freaking contract. I did get $7,500 check to sign. That was my signing bonus. I went out and bought a brand new Cutlass Supreme, blue, white leather tops, white bucket seats. That was my signing bonus. That baby was a gem. That's the contract I signed.
But still, what's missing? The Winston-Salem Polar Bears. It's not the San Diego Gulls in the Western Hockey League. And if I'm not mistaken, the Western Hockey League, the WHL, the Western Hockey League, that folded not a lot thereafter. But what got you to Winston-Salem?
Here's what happens. So I go to camp. Boom. I get sent to the AHL, Providence Reds. I am good enough to play on this team. I started the first two games. They're actually first two league games. It's not in the stats, but I did. Sat on the freaking bench. But what happened was, I was good enough to play. But St. Louis and New York, Providence was affiliated with two teams, not one. So now as training camp's going on, there's players from both sides coming down as the season began. So these guys have one-way contracts or two-way contracts. So I'm going to get bumps by some pretty good players. Whether they're better than me or not is irrelevant, because that's the political part of the game. So I'm sitting on the bench. John Muckler, who became NHL, you know, he has a storied career. He was the coach. And I remember sitting on the bench in Jaloup. We were playing against Nova Scotia. I said, I got to get in the game. I got to get the fight or something. I got to go over the boards. This is true. Anyway, big Jaloup, yeah, 6'5". He gets in a fight around. I think he's going to fight with our fans. I said, I'm going to jump over. I go fight Lupia. How freaking stupid can I be? I go to go over the boards. Muckler sees me going, pulls me back. It happened twice in this game where he actually pulled me back from going on to do something stupid. I landed back, and I'm pretty sure I landed on his patent leather shoes. He was not happy. Anyway, that game ends. I get a call in. I come to practice in the morning. Coach, to get in the office. Bucksy wants to see you. Hey, kid, here's your bus ticket. You're going to Port Huron. See you later. That's it. It's not, hey, work your ass off. Try to get back here. There it is. Ticket, boom. See you later, kid. Welcome to the big leagues. So I go to Port Huron.
Which is in Michigan, so it's not around the corner. That's a long trip.
No, it's in Michigan, right? And so I get down there a couple of days later. Bobby McCammon is the coach. Really good coach, good guy. Ended up becoming an NHL coach for years. It's just, I played eight games, got one goal. It just didn't fit with me. The guys were good. It was just the city, the team. Something didn't register that this is where I wanted to play. Was it disappointment getting sent down, even though it was good enough? I'm not sure. So anyway, McCammon called me in. He said, Holtzie, we're going to have to make a move here. And I said, Bobby, no problem. So who is coaching Winston-Salem, who is the affiliate of New York also, is, you're going to know the name, my mom's cousin, Forbes Kennedy. So Forbes Kennedy is my coach. So me being disappointed in getting set down, going to Port Huron, that just didn't work out. No hard feelings. I said, you know what? Maybe I don't even want to play. It took me, I think, 5 or 6 days to get to Winston-Salem. I come pulling in there, and Forby goes, where the hell have you been? I said, Forby, just, you know, took my time. He said, let's go. He took me right over. We had a couple beers. We broke the ice, and I could say Forbes Kennedy, ex-NHL, tough player, mom's cousin, woke me up and set my career back on its way.
What did he do to wake you up? And just for the record and for people out there listening, Port Huron to Winston-Salem, which is in North Carolina, it's a nice little 10-hour car trip. It's almost 700 miles. Back in the day, I guess it took you way longer than those 10 hours that are now issued on Google Maps. But apart from getting to know the USA, how did he wake you up? How did he make sure that there'd be a proper hockey career?
It all comes back to, we had a good bunch of guys too. Really good bunch of guys. Every player wants a coach that is tough, fair, and honest. And Forby Kennedy was tough as nails, tough practices, fair, and honest. That wakes up every player. The guys freaking love Forby. And I remember one time, he had no favorites, right? Because his brother Jamie also played on our team, Jamie Kennedy. And Forby was on him all the time. And you know, for a tough guy, NHL tough guy, Forbes Kennedy was petrified of mice. So one day we're in the room and the guy's going, hey, Holtz, you know what we're going to do to Forby? We got a mouse. And where he gets dressed, he's going to bend over, put up his skates, but we're going to tape it, a mouse. So when he sits up, that mouse is going to be dangling on his freaking coconut. I said, boys, if you guys do this, you better clear the track. Anyway, the guys did it. So Forby's in there and he's putting on his freaking skates and he feels something on his head. He looks up. It's a freaking mouse. Well, I swear to God, get out of the way. He ran right out of the freaking building with his skates on. This is one of the toughest guys in the freaking NHL. And it also happened at training camp in Point Claire, West Island. We had a Rangers rookie camp. Forby was there and Kenny Gassoff and the boys were sitting at these big tables up in the lobby having lunch. And Forby's sitting right beside me. And Kenny Gassoff said, Holtz, watch this. He made a mouse out of black tape. So Forby's sitting there. Hey, John Ferguson, all the management for the Rangers. Everybody's around having lunch. I'm talking to Forby. So I had and Kenny Gassoff put a mouse made out of black tape right beside Forby Kennedy's plate. Well, he looked over and I swear to God, here we go again. That table flew. Forby screamed, ran it out of the freaking rink again. These are actually factual stories. Forby Kennedy, tough NHL guy, petrified of mice, even a mouse made out of tape. But if you Google, Martin, if you Google Forbes Kennedy, when he was in the playoffs one year, he had that big stick fight. I think it was Kenny Green, and he ended up punching the referee, got fined $1,000, got suspended. It was a big, big do in the NHL. If you Google Forbes Canada, you're going to see some stories about Forby. One day in practice, during a game, we're there and we're playing and I jumped on the ice and we had too many men on the ice. We're playing at home. We had great fans, great city, great bunch of guys. And I'm a pretty good player. I jump on, Forby goes, you get in the box. So I come back to the box. I'm sitting on the bench. Next whistle, he goes, kid, get out of here. I say, Forby, what the fuck are you talking about? He says, you get your ass right down to the end and get off the ice. I go, holy shit. Hey, Forby, we're relatives. No, that ain't going to fly. I go down. The guys they open the door, the glass door. Holtz, what are you doing? And Forby sent me off. So I go in the room. I'm sitting in the medical room waiting. My first 2 years, I didn't wear a helmet. But down in this league, I'm wearing a helmet. And I had it off, and the players are coming in. And they say, Holtz, you better get that freaking helmet on, because when Forby comes in, he's going to freaking kill you. Oh, my God. I'm sitting there. I put my freaking helmet on. And my heart's just a pounding. Forby Kennedy comes in. Where's the kid? He comes walking in, looks at me, shuts the door. We had a little talk. He said, I'll give you one crack at this kid. You better go out there and play your freaking ass off. Whoa, I survived that meeting. And do you think I played good the rest of that game? I played good the rest of the year.
Help me out on one thing, because over our elite prospects, where a lot of our good friends are doing some heavy lifting and provide some great work and share, or the stats that are in the hockey realms with basically humankind. It says the Winston-Salem polar bears. But if you watch or if you Google the Southern Hockey League that folded a couple years later, where Winston-Salem was a part of, it says the Polar Twins. What was it?
We were the Polar Twins.
So there's a correction for our good friends over at Elite Prospects. One of the two affiliates with the New York Rangers, the Winston-Salem Polar Twins, how did you stay in touch with the organization? Was there some kind of a monthly update, call of sorts, just to let you know how you're doing and what needed to be done to make it to the National Hockey League? Or did they just let you spend time there, collect some points, which you did regularly? You were a point per game scorer with Winston-Salem, but how did you know that you made the right kind of progress?
Absolutely no word. We're just living. I mean, I got engaged a couple of times. I got engaged to Patty Brandt in the Ice Capades after a week. That's quite a story, too. Mom and Dad knew. Forby Kennedy, actually, were at a party, and he called my dad. He said, "Hey, Gordy, we've got a problem with your kid." I said, "What's he doing now?" He said, "He's got a bag of rings he's passing around. He's getting engaged all the freaking time." So that's kind of a funny story. Sorry to get off beat there. No. Whether they talked to Forby, I had no idea. Never heard a word. But here's what happens. We get into the playoffs. And I remember we're playing in, I think it was in Hampton. And I had three fights with, I think it was Kenny Southwick in the same shift. Three fights. The fans were fighting. They had to stand me at center ice to get me out of the freaking rink. It was so wild. Those were the crazy old times. But what happened was, when we lost out in the playoffs, I was now dating a gal. And we hit the road right after the season, and we went to Florida. Little did I know, because we had no cell phones or any way of contacting me, the Providence Reds had called me up for the playoffs in the AHL. Well, little did I know, I'm in freaking Florida on the beach. So nobody can get a hold of me. Parents, Forby, anybody, because they don't know where the hell I am. So I did get called up to the Providence Reds at the end of the season, probably to be on a taxi squad or whatever, but I was missing in action.
Incredible. But yeah, this is the way how things worked and life was lived when there were no cell phones and when there wasn't like digital communication. So how did you go about your business after? I mean, you finished the season, or at the very least you thought you had finished the season, you had a vacation, but what was the next step on your kind of list towards making or realizing the big goal of making it to the National Hockey League?
Never thought about it. I went back from Florida because I was dating, I think it was Miss North Carolina. She was quite the gal, but that's a whole other story. And I went back after the Florida trip to Winston-Salem. And I spent at least a month there or more, because don't forget, I made $9,000 and a couple of bonuses. So I was working construction through our contacts and team. And one night we flew over to Miami in a little private plane, four guys. We went over to do a job. I was kind of like the gopher, go for this, go for that. I was the helper type of thing. But I flew with these guys. And I remember when we flew back, we hit a storm with this little plane. And I swear to God, how we made it, I have no idea. We got through that storm somehow. I thought we were done. Got back, I worked construction, 5-6 weeks, make a few bucks, drove back to Montreal, did my working out, training, running, doing weights, being wild. It never crossed my mind. And then I drove all the way back to see that gal 18 hours straight. I went back once after that to see her, go back to Montreal. And then I go eventually to the New York Rangers camp in my second year. And now my contract is a two-way contract, $60,000 in New York, which is pretty good back then. A lot of guys in the NHL were making 30, 35, and 40. And my American League contract was 20, also respectable. So now I have a two-way contract, which means nothing. They can still send you down to the Southern League or the IHL. I go to training camp in my second year.
You do understand that I just tried to Google Miss North Carolina and ended up with all the or a list of Miss North Carolinas from basically all the way.
Well, she was Miss something.
Back when it started. Well, I can read you the names of the Miss North Carolinas from 70.
Was there an Anne Hope on there?
Nope. No Anne Hope.
Okay, so she was a beauty. She was educated, top tennis player, top this. She sang in the band. She was Miss something down there. And that was after I got engaged to Patty Brandt, who was in the Ice Capades. And mom and dad still laugh about that because this summer, when I was going through my storage in Canada, I found a letter from Brandt because I have lots of letters. And it was from her, a picture of her. We had got engaged. When I broke it off a couple weeks later, she was quite disappointed. And her name was Patty Brandt. And you know what my mom told me 2 days ago when I talked to her? She says, Greg, when you called and said you got engaged to Patty Brandt, and they asked why? And I said, Mom, she's got beautiful legs. Whatever.
I just think it's interesting and... Maybe just shows how wild the days back then were and how much thought or not enough thought was put into certain things that you did get engaged and didn't hold up too long. So I guess there's that. But we're approaching the season that got you your first two games in the National Hockey League. It's the 75-76 season. You are the two-way contract that you just mentioned, you being in Rangers camp. But how did it go from there? What was a quote-unquote results of camp? Where did you end up, immediately in American Hockey League or with the National Hockey League team?
Well, I get to camp and I'm doing good. Like I can stick out, like a deep guys, I could score, and I'm kind of like the way it's looking on the roster, kind of the fifth centerman. Top six for sure, probably top five. Esposito, Wayne Dillon, Walter Tkachuk, Stemkowski, all big names that were fixed set in there. So, no, I played a couple exhibition games, and I did end up in my two or three years in camp, I played eight exhibition games, two in Philly, Islanders, against Gordie Howe at Hartford. I played eight exhibition games, and I scored against all the teams that were the teams. I scored four goals in eight games. So I know I could score. But anyway, so I go to camp, had a couple exhibition games, scored in one, I'm sure, probably in Philly, I can't quite remember. As we played two games of Philly against that team. That was pretty scary. So I get sent to the American League. I'm a good player. My first game against, I think it was Nova Scotia, the top team. I am freaking flying. I'm not sure if mom and dad were at the game or not. I had two goals. I am flying. I remember this. Then I went down again, some middle of the game somewhere, and I made a move on a veteran defenseman, and I got freaking rocked. Hip checked, wrecked my knee, off I went, came back during the game, kind of beat up, finished the game, but I was flying to this point. So I had a brace made right away. Not sure if I missed a couple games or not, but couldn't have been a lot worse. Had the brace on. Now I'm on my way to having a hell of a year. And played with Eddie Johnstone, Boyd Anderson. Probably we were maybe the top line, if not one of the top two or three in the whole league. So now I'm on my way. John Buckner's coached. You know the history of him sending me down the year before. So anyway, we're rolling along and I'm doing pretty freaking good. So where do you want me to go from there? My first game, get when I get called up?
That have been a natural follow-up question. What do you remember of November 26, 1975?
Sad story. I'll tell you a sad story. Like, but it wakes your eyes up to what it's like. So I'm now one of the top scorers in the American Hockey League. I'm on a great line. We're practicing out at the college in Providence, I think Providence College. So the guys, we would put our gear on, drive to practice, drive back after practice. So we had a couple days off after our last game. So we played the game the night before, but now we have like 3-4 days off. So we all went out after the game and got lit up pretty good. We got kind of drunk and had a bunch of fun. So now when you go to practice next day, you know you're going to skate hard to sweat it out, A, B, C, D. It's just how it was. So we do a couple drills, and then we start scrimmaging. So I'm sitting on the bench, and I'm not on my line with Eddie Johnstone and Boyd Anderson. Somebody else is on the line. So I'm sitting there, and 5 goes by, 10 minutes goes by, 15. I'm just sitting there. But I remember when we were skating in warm-up just before, at the beginning of practice, skating around, I remember John Muckler was looking at me and he kind of was shaking his head. Like, and I said to one of the guys, what the fuck is he looking at? No idea. So anyway, now I'm sitting on the bench. This follows up his weird looks. I'm sitting there for 20 minutes. I'm getting cold. I said, screw this. I freaking quit. I leave and go get changed. I am out at the car waiting for my roommate, Gordy Beinack. Gordy comes out. He said, Holtzy, Muxy wants to see in his office. I said, what the fuck's he want? Anyway, so I go back in. I walk into his room. He slams the freaking door. He says, sit down. What do you think? I benched you in practice. Just like that. I said, Muxy, I have no idea. Maybe I didn't play good last night. I don't know. Was I a little cocky? Yeah, possibly. He said, you got called up. You got to be on the plane this afternoon or tomorrow morning, whatever it was. You're going to Atlanta to play your first game at the NHL. You're fine. $25. Get the hell out of here. Yeah, you're pretty quiet too, because that is factual. So I think to myself, what the hell was that? Now, wouldn't a coach, and I'm this, one of his top players, wouldn't a coach say, hey, kid, I know you had a few beers last night, work your ass off, sweat it out, you got called up, this is an exciting day for you. I would have been so freaking excited. I would have been flying to practice, hungover or not. That was the preparation for my first game in the NHL.
That first
now,
game.
You want to hear about my first shift? That's a great story.
Now, I want to know something before we talk about that, because that first game with the New York Rangers happened on said November 26, 1975, and that's what the records are showing against the Boston Bruins. Let me know.
No. My first game was in Atlanta. My first game in the Gardens was against Boston.
Let me just see.
Well, you're the stat guy. You dig up stats I don't even know about. So
Well, the record shows that your second game happened at Atlanta, but that was half a year later.
No, it's reversed. It's reversed.
Is it? Because it's the NHL database. I'd say that's pretty accurate, but I'll dig a little deeper. I got two games for the 75-76 season right here. One of them happened in March. Apparently, it's the Rangers at the Atlanta Flames back then. And the first one is happened on November 26th, 1975. So basically 4.5 months earlier.
Well, all I remember was that one in Atlanta. And I remember that vaguely being my first game, but irrelevant. Boston, my first game in the Gardens against Boston. Mom and Dad drive up from Montreal. And they hit, you know, it's not like they could just hop and fly up. They have to drive. It's a long way. They hit a snowstorm. They didn't get into the rink until halfway through the game. But little did they know, I hadn't even seen the ice yet. But so in the third period, with the fans being quite restless, what was going on the ice, they throw me out there. Well, you kind of get an applause because the new kid, maybe he could do something. So it was quite exciting, quite nerve-wracking. So I remember Wayne Cashman, who was one of the tough guys, good player, tough guy in Boston. He went towards the net, and I gave him a little shot. And he kind of fell down, and he was on his knees. I remember this. On his knees, looking at me, and looked like he was getting ready to spear me. And I'm sure he saw my eyes as wide open as freaking flying saucers. And he stopped. So I was minus one on my first shift. Somebody scored somewhere along the way. I got this fierce look from Wayne Cashman. So I go off my second shift. I'm on the ice. I go into the corner and tie up a player. Give him a little shot in the back, like to the pucks in between his feet. And my legs started shaking. Because when I looked up, it was number four, Bobby Orr. And I freaking didn't know what to do. This is Bobby Orr, who I met that summer at one of Eagleson's golf tournaments, because all Eagleson's clients, I met Bobby Orr, had enough guts to sit down beside him. I was with a buddy of mine, Scotty Garland, who played for the Leafs. He said, "Greg, oh, there's Bobby Orr. You go sit beside him." No, you. So I snuck in when Scotty went to the bathroom. And I sat down, I told Bobby Orr the story. He said, "Hey, Greg, how you doing?" Freaky knows my name. Holy shit. Because Eagleson's clients, right? I told him the story. He was gracious. He said, "You can hit Bobby anytime you want. Just don't hurt me." I said, "Bobby, thank you very much. I have to go now." That is factual.
Speaking of factual things, I think you were the one who told me many, many times that you got so many hits to your head and had so many concussions that you might scramble with dates and things and when it happened, and did you mix them up a little? Maybe this is what happened. I'll send you the link to the research websites that I'm using, and you can figure it out for yourself. But first year, two NHL games played, Boston and Atlanta, you going against the great Bobby Orr. And just to give people an idea of how influential Bobby Orr was, he, to this day, still the only defenseman to win a scoring title in the National Hockey League. He did it twice, by the way. He revolutionized the position. He's one of the greatest defensemen of all time, and you haven't added. But only two games played in the National Hockey League. Finished both of them with a minus next to the plus-minus number. Minus one against the Bruins, minus two against the Atlanta Flames. Why was it so hard to make it stick in the National Hockey League? Why did you get sent back to the American Hockey League?
Well, I'd say I was the fifth centerman, right? So you got four big names, and they're all on one-way contracts, and that plays a role too. You know, I got called up two times, not when I was leading the AHL in scoring. I got called up twice, or when I was playing great. I got called up twice when I was hurt. Like, how does that work? So you get called up, and you're not at the top of your game. So I can't answer the question. If I would have stayed for the fifth and sixth year when they offered me another contract, maybe I would have figured that part out. Was I good enough to play? I honestly believe I was. I scored 4 goals in 8 exhibition games. In the 11 games I played, I had a couple goalposts in Montreal, my hometown. 2-0 breakaway with Greg Poulos in Detroit, Olympia Stadium. 2-0. Just passed me the puck. The guys on the bench were actually pissed off. They said, Polcat, pass that kid the puck. It's his first goal. Almost scored on Esposito in Chicago. Almost scored in Toronto. Made the front page of the Globe and Mail or the Toronto Star back then. What are the chances of that? I was playing with Satch, my brother-in-law. What are the chances of that? So even though I just couldn't get that first goal, and it kind of haunts me to this day. And if you score a couple, I remember after the game in Montreal, we lost 5-0. I was going against Reggie Houle, one of their good players, all night. The Flowers playing for them, Guy Lafleur. I had a post and a half for 2 goalposts and missed another great score. I could have had 2 or 3 goals. We lose 5-0. Next day, or a couple of days later, Fergie said, hey, tough one, kid. Should have popped a couple. Back to the minors. But you know what happened in that game? You want to hear a sad story? Mom and dad come to the game. I'm not supposed to play. There was rumors around I'm going to get traded to, I think it was L.A. So the night before, I'm at the Manoir having a beer with a couple of my buddies. Like, what are you doing in town? I'm playing tomorrow, but I think I'm not going to play. But I had a couple of beers, nothing major. I get to practice in the morning, and Esposito told me, Phil Esposito, he said, hey, Greg, just letting you know, you're going to play tonight. I said, what? Whoa. So get this one. I don't tell mom and dad, my jersey, Jimmy Young, the trainer, gets my jersey organized because I'm going to play. And I see it hanging up at my stall, and it's spelt wrong. H-O-L-T-S. I said, Jimmy, what the hell is that? What? It's S-T. Oh, shit. I said, this is my freaking hometown. Jimmy Young fixes the last 2 letters. The S was still a little bit crooked, but at least you had it in the right order. So anyway, I play the game. You know, you're going against Guy Lafleur, Larry Robinson. This is my team growing up. Talk about exciting. Mom and dad take pictures during the game. Many pictures during the game. Talk about souvenirs. We sent the film in. The only film that was misplaced or lost in the history of our family.
No
was
way.
Me playing in Montreal.
No way.
Could have. We never got the pictures. Maybe a couple of Frenchmen who are diehard Canadians fans saw these pictures and kept them. Only film that was never returned to us in our whole life.
Boy.
And it turned out to be the only game I played in Montreal.
How unlucky. And thing is, you started jumping around a little bit with the 3 seasons that saw you play in the National Hockey League, because that had to happen in your third and last year of playing hockey in North America for the New York Rangers. So I'm flipping around and switching around the years a little too. And I want to get to the season 76-77. And
hey, can I? Okay, go ahead.
No, sure. You go
ahead. I want to tell you something. When I was in Providence, I'm going to tell you a little bit about coaching and politics or power. There's five games to go. I think it's five games to go in the AHL. I am tied for the scoring lead with Jean-Guy Gretton and Ronnie Andruff. I am up for Rookie of the Year. I'm up for MVP, and I'm up for the top scorer. This is hockey news. This is the talk, right? We're playing at home against Springfield. They were the last place team or one of the bottom teams. Mom and dad drive up to the game. I played two shifts.
Why? Yeah.
You tell me. I was absolutely fuming.
Jesus.
So, guys were trying to settle me down. I was absolutely livid. So we get on the road the last three games. I think we're playing the Baltimore in three tough rinks. I played like 22, 24 minutes a game. I'm now 4 or 5 points behind in the scoring. Now I'm playing. I'm getting the shit beat out of me right before the playoffs. I finished third in the freaking scoring. You tell me, how does that work? So then we get in the playoffs. We're playing Rochester. And the first game we lost in Rochi, and the guy I was going up against got three goals. And I get back, and Muxie, the coach, calls me, and he said, hey, you better do something about it next game against that sentiment. Well, I'm their top scorer. I said, okay. So we go home, and I go out there, and I fight. I get thrown out of the game. You figure it out. Went after the guy that got the three goals, and I fought. I ended up pulling his hair because he had a big mop of hair and I had long hair. And we had a good scrap, and I got five plus game because I pulled hair. So now I go back to the third game and freaking Rochester, and they're all waving purses at me because I pulled his hair. Like, here we go. Have fun. You got to love the game.
I want to round out your North American career with kind of two stories that happened away from the ice. One is a funny one that still connects you to the person to this day. The other one, a scary one. Which story do you want to start with?
Well, let's start with the fun one. Because if we start with the other one, I might not live through it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, of course. We'll jump to the 76-77 season. You playing together with a guy that we've already heard from twice, actually here on 70 in 7. He's Lawrence Satchuk. His friends, of course, call him Satch. And it's about how he became your brother-in-law. How did that work?
Could I backtrack and tell you the first time I saw Larry Satchuk?
Sure.
I'm playing in American Hockey in Providence, and I'm, you know, one of the top players with a couple other guys. So we're sitting in the players' corner. That was our bar, a couple streets over from the rink. We're sitting in there having a couple beers. So this kind of Cadillac or Bentley, some fancy, big, fancy car pulls up, and it's Derek. He was a flamboyant, playboy, great hockey player, kind of one of my guys I kind of thought was one of my idols, and Satch, who I didn't know, but was with him. They walk in and sit at the bar. And we're sitting over that table. I said, that's the Turk. That's Sanderson. Who's the other guy? Oh, that's Satch. Holy shit. They ordered a couple drinks that were on fire. Shots. And they lit them, and the things are on fire. So they pounded these things. We're going, what the hell? So they had a second one. It's a shot of whatever the hell it is. And they lit it up. They pounded the second one. And they left. And I remember turning to the guys. I said, guys, we're drinking the wrong shit. That's why we're not in the Apple. So when they left, we ordered one of those flaming flamingos or whatever the hell they were. That was the first time I ever saw Satch. Other than, yeah.
Yeah, but how did it come that you grew close?
Well, when I got called up, I was up one time for like 3 weeks or a month. I only played a couple of games, but I was there. And I love that because in one, if you make 60,000 for 6 months, I made 10 grand in 1 month. That's like freaking, whoa. I stayed with Satch at a house where he was staying on Long Beach, because we all stayed on Long Beach, which is about an hour from New York. That's where we practiced. Home of the New York Rangers, Long Beach. That's where we connected. So we were kind of, and then when he got, excuse me, that's when he got sent down to the Haven, that's where we already had a connection from New York a little bit and New Haven. So that's how it kind of began.
But then again, it takes a whole different level of trust and friendship and everything that goes into it to set a teammate up with to a blind date with your sister. How did that work?
Well, me and Shelly are very close, my sister, and I was dating a gal named Lindy Schofer. And her and Shelly were good friends. So Lindy was going to fly down to see me for a long weekend or whatever it was. And me and Sats were out having some beers, and I say, Shelly's, I think she was 19, good looking. And I said, hey, maybe Shelly should fly down with Lindy and you can meet her. And Satch goes, well, I don't know. Like, what does she look like? So we're looking through magazines trying to find somebody who looks like her. I said, Satch, she's good looking, which she was, right? And in good shape and everything. So anyway, is this going to come about? Well, Satch kind of phones her and they get a connection. And I remember sitting in the airport in New Haven. And they both were having a drink and we're waiting for them. They come off the plane. Shelly's dark haired, Lindy's blonde hair. And Satch goes, which one's mine? I said, the blonde's mine. The other one's my freaking sister. We had a good laugh. Off they went. Stayed at Satch at a house. We had our apartments or whatever we had. And then my parents got wind of this, because they were out of town and they were fuming. Where is Shelly? Like, get home, whatever. I can't remember exactly how it went. Anyway, they spent a couple of days and they had a great time. And Shelly flew home, as Lindy did. And, oh, no, you're not going back or whatever. But I think first chance, Satch was a pretty smooth talker too. And somehow he got her back there again. Not to mom and dad's happiness. If you're going to talk about a blind date being atop the list, not only do they have four kids, they have eight grandkids. I'd say this is one of the greatest blind dates in mankind.
And you connected to this day, and you're really good friends. We're going to hear from Lawrence, Larry, Satch, Satcharok in a bit here on part three of 17-7. But I've got two more questions until we quickly go to a break, or two more kind of topics. The scary story happened a year after. You being held at gunpoint. I hope a feeling no one out there ever has to experience. Unfortunately, it tends to happen in certain places of this planet or on this planet. But what led to you having held a gun to your head?
Well, probably young, wild, crazy, drunk, the whole package, right? So now I'm dating another gal. Her name is Linda. And Linda's in town living with me in New Haven.
By the way, quite the dating turnover.
Yeah, you could say that. But Lindy Schofer, the first one, she was, maybe one I let get away. But she was a great gal. We did have a good time. So things happen and you move on. So now I'm dating Linda, and Linda's a very good-looking girl. So Satch and Shelly are living together. We both have two really nice houses on the water, separate, two doors down in New Haven. So me and Satch, even back then, Providence, New Haven, there's parts of town you should not be hanging around. Anyway, me and Satch on our own, we're off at this place. We're playing pool. It's kind of a bar away from downtown, wherever it was. I can't exactly remember, but yeah, you got to be careful. So we're getting drunk and there's lots of snow outside. It's deep snow. So the girls are coming to get us, to see us, whatever, but we're pretty loaded. Me and Linda get in an argument as usual, and we're walking out, and I kind of just push her a bit into the snowbank, which is almost her height. I just say, oh, yeah, you know, leave me alone type of thing, whatever. So there's a big guy, bigger than me, and there's a guy a little bit smaller than me. And they say, hey, what the fuck you doing? I said, go screw yourself. So here I go. I'm going to fight the big guy. And the girls are going, oh, no, and such, whatever. Anyway, the little guy says, I'll take care of him. I got to remember this as best I can because I sobered up pretty freaking quick. He pulled out a silver piece with a white handle. He put it right over towards my coconut. And he said, hey, I'll take care of him. Well, holy shit. All of a sudden, the girls, they're jumping around, screaming and such. Okay, everything settled. We got it settled down because I'm still here. That's how life can change so quickly. So we walk now across the street. This is unbelievable. Satch has a white Eldorado, big white Cadillac Eldorado, beautiful car. What is sitting in the back seat? A brick. A brick was thrown through the back seat, which was sitting on the thing. So I'm now sitting in the back where that window hole is with the ice cold air coming in, which I love because I'm not dead. I am alive. So you get into the wrong part of town. A gun comes out. There's a brick through the window, not from these guys, from somebody else walking by in Sasha's white Eldorado. And that is the way it is.
Last question until we go to a break. You played in a National Hockey League. You played 199 games in the American Hockey League, scored 167 points. You were good. So why did you go to Europe?
It was rough and tough, right? A lot of politics with the coaching things that went on. Like I told you one time, European scouts, when I was in New Haven, were there to watch players, and obviously I was one of them. And I got benched. So there was a lot of politics and stuff going on. But, you know, I did dig my own holes, probably out a little bit too wild. Sometimes I know the whole league was kind of like that. We were kind of wild, drank a lot and stuff. It's no excuse. I just think it was a way I'd get a game because we go into these games. It was tough, a lot of fighting and dirty and it was really a tough, great life, but tough way to live. So anyway, the Rangers offer me another two-year contract, 60-20. You have seen the contract visually. I said, well, why am I not getting a one-way contract? Thinking I should be, don't ask me why. Then I got a call from Derek Holmes from Hockey Canada. And he said, Greg, would you be interesting to go to Germany, to Mannheim? I say, why? Like I didn't have a connection to Europe. He said, well, here's what's happening. Players are going over now in their careers, having great careers, Europe, whatever. I said, oh, so I met Derek Holmes and I was going to Mannheim for $30,000 US plus bonuses. That's net. That's a lot of money. So I'm going to Mannheim. Now, Darryl Maggs was a defenseman who was going to Innsbruck. And I guess his agent must have been Danny McCann, who became my agent after. Mannheim all of a sudden needed a defenseman. So we kind of made a swap, which I said, okay, so Danny McCann came to my house. He said, Greg, is going to go to Germany through Derek Holmes, whatever. I'm not sure how that was. But we can get you into Innsbruck for 18,000 US plus good bonuses. flights, apartment, car, all the stuff. I said, oh, okay. Oh, I'll go to Innsbruck. Let's give it a try for 1 year. He says, but you have to sign a life contract with me. I said, well, why? He said, if not, I'll sign these two other players. And he told me their names. I said, well, Danny, these two guys aren't close to being as good as I am. He said, no, but they'll sign a life contract with me. Huh. So another part of the business, right? So anyway, I go to Innsbruck. That's how I ended up in Innsbruck.
But if I had told you in spring or summer of 78, right before you signed a contract with Innsbruck, that this would be, or that the year before was the last year, or would be the last year you ever play professional hockey on North American soil, what would you have answered me?
I would have said, not a chance, because this was an experiment to go for 1 year. Because some reason I felt I should have had a one-way contract. No, I would have said, no, I'm going to go 1 year, see how it is. Do you know what happened after my first year? After having a really good year, exciting, good, life-changing. I go back to Montreal. I'm the fifth centerman. I would have been the fifth centerman again. Who was in the Stanley Cup Finals in Montreal? The New York Rangers. So me and Kenny McCarthy, my good buddy, we go down to the Montreal Forum for one of the games when the Rangers were in Montreal. We have no tickets. We're walking outside the Forum. We're going to go down, hang around, go for a beer. Nicky Fatio, the big tough guy who I room with in two training camps, is walking in front of the Montreal Forum. And he said, Holtzy, is that you? Greg, what are you doing here? He picks me up. This is unbelievable. He said, you coming to watch us play? I said, no, me and Kenny, we have no tickets. Come on. He got us in the freaking rink, Montreal Forum, to watch the game. We went right down to the dressing room. Now the guys are coming on to start the game, and I'm standing there. Kenny's not too far behind me. And here's walking by the guys. Duguay, Hickey, the boys, and they're walking by me. And I think it was Duguay. I said, one of the guys said, Holtzy, what are you doing here? Shit, go get your gear on. We need some goals. This is in the finals in the freaking NHL. 1 year after I went to Innsbruck.
We'll get to the Innsbruck part in depth, just as we talked about your time in the American Hockey League, in the Southern Hockey League, almost in the Western Hockey League, in so many different leagues. I guess we'll take a quick break, take a couple of deep breaths, and talk about Innsbruck. The experiment that turned out to be the second and biggest part of your active playing career. Quick break here on 70 in 7, and then we're back.
Win today, hockey, no fun. Do you enjoy listening to Win Today, Hockey O'Clock? If that is the case, then please rate the podcast. A 5-star rating or a review over at the podcast dealer of your choice would go a long way in helping to spread the good word of hockey. Win Today, Hockey O'Clock, the hockey podcast with real and open-ended hockey conversations.
Win Today, Hockey O'Clock.
Back on 70 in 7, part 3, the third decade of Greg Holt's hockey life. We touch base on everything that happened in North America, but he went, as you said, on a 1 year adventure. It was an experiment to play hockey in Austria. Why did you stay in Austria?
Well, what happened was we started off the season and I get over there and, you know, I finished in the middle of May. We lost in the finals in the American Hockey League to Maine. And in the finals, I was actually second in the playoff scoring to a guy named, I think it was Hughes, played for Montreal the following year. So here I am now going from the finals, second top scorer in the American Hockey League. And a couple months later, I'm playing in freaking Innsbruck. So, but I went over for a month. We had a few games, exhibition games. And my first game in the summer in Europe, we played against a German team. And we had a couple extra players, Carl Brewer, the great defenseman, he came in and played. And we're playing down in Germany. And this is, I thought Europe was like easy. Like they play with eggs in their pocket. This was tough. I got a scrap, got two-handed me. I broke the top of my hand, like the bone in my hand. Anyway, so I sit around for the few weeks, didn't play the last games. So the first game I played in Innsbruck before the season started in the summer was against Mannheim. Can you imagine? And I haven't skated now for like, I took the cast off and I hadn't played in the 3 weeks or the month, whatever it was. And Eli Vordachuk, who became a good friend of mine, he was a good player there. We played 7-7. I'll never forget it. That's where I met Ellie on the ice. I scored 2 goals, 2 assists by just taking my cast off. And now there was a little bit of a buzz going around at Innsbruck. So I went home for a couple of weeks, came back, and now I'm back to Innsbruck to start the season and let the fun begin.
Do you have any recollection of your very first league game? Because I got a date, and I got a score.
Well, I know my first game at Klangford. I know that one. I don't remember the first league game that I played in Innsbruck, no.
Not in Innsbruck. Your very first league game that happened against Vienna, the old Vienna ice hockey club that went with the abbreviation VEV, W-E-V. And the first game that you ever played on Austrian soil happened on October 7th, 1978. A 4-3 wow. Loss. And yeah, thanks to the great researchers here at Win Today Hockey O'Clock, there'll be some more great stats and quotes from newspaper articles from here on out, because
we lost 4-3. Did I score?
That's the thing. We don't know. We'd have to dig up the game sheet, but at the very least, we were able to nail down your first
interesting
league appearance. But speaking of the Klagenfurt game, why does this one come to mind first?
Well, because as we had talked about with a couple of our podcasts with the people there too, you know, they were the big team. So I go in there my first game. I played there. I'm pretty sure it was my first game there. And I had a headbanded warm-up and stuff. And we won 7-4 and I got 4 goals. I remember scoring 4 goals my first game at Klagenfurt. And I loved that rink. I love the colors. They were the best team. I just love playing in that freaking rink. And I remember that. And talk about an exciting place to play in Klagenfurt. And of course, over the years, Innsbruck, Klagenfurt, whenever Klagenfurt, my whole career, when they came to Innsbruck, it was a full house. They were draw number one in Innsbruck.
Why the headband?
Well, because even when I played in Fialek at 35, a bunch of the guys, Kenny Strong and all the guys, Wilson, they wore a headband. And don't forget, when I played in Vienna, I wore a headband in practice, no helmet. I have pictures to prove it. I would wear a headband and no helmet because I played pro, don't forget, for 2 years with no helmet. So I loved it. I mean, the hair is flowing as you skate down the freaking ice. This is pretty exciting. So you wear it just... couple NHL guys, Henry Boucher, a couple other guys had wore headbands. And it was cool. Long hair, headband. It kind of gives you feel a little bit wild. And thought I was.
The numbers from your first year in Innsbruck do jump out. You said it wasn't a cakewalk playing in Europe, but you still had an incredible year, scoring 2 points per game, 68 points in 34 league appearances. Did scoring in Austria come naturally to you?
Well, no, don't forget. First of all, I couldn't believe we played 34 games. I mean, I just finished playing in American Life and probably had 15 or 18 playoff games. And I think one time I had 17 games. It was the most I ever played in a month in the AHL. So now we're playing like, wow, Tuesday, Saturdays. This is freaking weird. So, well, don't forget back then, there was two imports, Paul Popiel and myself, and Pope was an NHL player. You know, we're coming out of top leagues. And the guys that we were just better. And the guys were pretty good players too. But, you know, Kaffenberg had the Yakishevs and the Gurievs and these fantastic world-class players. So every team had two really good imports. And the home guys, well, but don't forget, Martin, I could always score. I mean, I scored in the AHL a lot of goals. I scored in every team I was in, every league. So now coming here where I could take the puck and deke and dive, I could score. And I remember in some practices, I would score so many goals in practice, the guys would just laugh.
Take us back, or let's do a trip down memory lane, because the interesting thing is I got some attendance numbers from that year, 78, 79, and also the fact that there were indeed TV broadcasts of some of the games, but I got an attendance number that's in the 7,000s in Innsbruck. As of right now, Innsbruck has a rink that probably could be host to 2,800. So how popular was hockey back then, the first year you played in Innsbruck?
Well, it didn't start out like that. It started out with, you know, your 15 or 17 or 1800, if I remember correctly. But because I could play and I was an attractive player because I could freaking stick handle and deke guys and score. And had some bite to me too. Word got around pretty quick that there's this new kid in town. And all of a sudden, we started getting 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. Cartier comes to town, we got a full house. And it didn't seem like much back then, but now, when I look back and see the articles and the guys talk about it, when you got a whole crowd screaming, go Holtz, go, it registers now how special that was. But at the time, it just all seemed freaking normal to me. But it wasn't normal. So I'm going to tell you a story, though, something that changed my way of thinking a little bit, whether it's right or wrong. We get into a Christmas tournament in my first year. We're playing Augsburg first, and now we're playing the big German team, Cologne, with all the top stars. A guy named Erleman was their owner, GM owner, whatever he was. Big money guy. We had, Zurilla, the world champion goalie, is in nets for Augsburg. We play them on the Friday or this Saturday, the first game. We beat them. I think there was, if I remember right, between 3,000 and 4,000 people at the game, which is a lot. It's an exhibition game, a little few games at Christmas. First face-off, I score 7 or 8 seconds in. I just flipped it past that guy, deked those defensemen. Their jock straps are still up in the freaking chandeliers, and I score. Well, now the place is buzzing. We beat them 5-3. I got 3 or 4 goals. Next night, there's 9 or 10,000 at the game, 8,000. People were in. It was so full against Cologne that the people were sitting on the freaking stairs. This is freaking unbelievable. Like, to me, you know, I played in the gardens, I played at a shell, played in American League, full house. But this is freaking wild. So I understood after Ehrlichman had told the players, if Holt score, every goal you score, we're going to get 50 euros each, or 50, whatever it was back then, shillings or whatever. And if Holt scores, you get deducted. I found this out after. We lost 12-2. I had a breakaway late. I didn't score. I remember this. I went in the room totally embarrassed. Paul Popiel, NHL player, defenseman, great guy. He came in fuming. We sit down. And what happens next blew my freaking mind. One of the head guys from the team, I think it was Mr. Ryder, came walking in with a tray full of champagne glasses and champagne. I looked over at Pope and I said, are you fucking kidding me? What is this? Right there, something changed in my mind. It was business. It was money. They made all kinds of money. They were happy. Me and Paul Peel, we were freaking mega pissed off. That I remember as if it was yesterday.
Your first season in Europe ends the same way many others did, with Klagenfurt hoisting the championship. You made the kind of master round, the round where the phase of the championship where the last or best four teams played in a round robin against each other. Different formats, different ways to get to the championship over the next couple of years. We might hit on this, but after the conclusion of, for you, a short year with only 34 games played, there's a headline in one of the Austrian newspapers, and it did say, will Greg Holst be playing for the Austrian national team in the foreseeable future, as in very soon? How accurate was that, and at what point did it ever cross your mind to get Austrian citizenship to be able to play for the national team?
It never crossed my mind at all. Like, why would it? I was planning on going back home, right? But then when we started talking contract, my second year, So my contract, my second year, which I believe Danny McCann did, with I had some saying yes or no. After that, I did my own after that, was 40,000 US tax-free. Plus apartment, plus car, plus flights, plus the bonuses. My contract in New York would have been 60,000 takeaway. So it would have been around the same, but I would have had to pay for my car, my apartment, my stuff. So my contract in my second year in Innsbruck was actually better than my NHL contract. And if you might not remember this, you probably wouldn't because you weren't born. The shilling was 25-1 to the dollar. So this was $1 million net I made in my second year. And I knew nothing about the shillings, a dollar, or whatever. I just send money home and stuff. But that was interesting. So what happened was, they came to me after the season, I guess it was. It wasn't during the season. Excuse me. And they said, would you like to become an Austrian, get your Austrian passport? So what was my logical answer? I said, why? So their logical answer is, because if you're Austrian, we can get a third import. It had nothing to do with the Austrian national team. That's how that came. So I said, well, now that I'm going to stay and I'm going to sign, why not? So they take me to the city hall, and I could speak a little bit of German, you know, broken, because I wasn't shy. I learned a little bit, but not good enough to be an Austrian citizen, really. The guy starts talking, and I go, whoa, all right, sign here. Okay, danke schön. I signed. I'm now Austrian.
Wouldn't fly in this day and age. Just side note here.
A few guys, but no. So that's how I became Austrian. But here's one. So I go home now to Montreal. I get a call from John Ferguson, who used to be coach of the Rangers. He's now in Winnipeg. And he said, Holtsey, would you like to meet downtown Montreal? And I think his name was Sutherland, was the GM. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure it was. So Sutherland and John Ferguson, one of the toughest NHL guys to ever play, meets me. We meet at a bar called the Hunter's Horn, which is a pickup joint for elderly folks. I walk in. I got my jeans on, my cowboy boots. Boom, I walk in. And Fergie says, the first thing he said to me, geez, Holtsey, Greg, you're a little bit bigger than I thought. Well, I got my cowboy boots on. I said, well, whatever. They said, would you be interested in coming to the Winnipeg hockey team, NHL? And I said, well, what's the deal? Yes, no, I did get offered something from New York. I can't remember how the conversation went. But he said, I said, can I get a one-way contract? He said, no, we can't give you a one-way. We can only give you a two-way. And I mentioned what I'm doing in Europe. And I said, I got a good contract. He told him, here's what I'm making. And he goes, no. He said, Greg, I'm going to get this. John Ferguson said this to me. I'm going to give you some advice then. You're not that big. You can play. The game has changed. You might be able to have a really good long career in Europe. I said, well, thanks for the talk and Bowman. I left. That is also an interesting story.
I guess it's time to hear from a good friend of yours and someone who, of course, sent in a voice message. Someone who I asked, where are the first few years for Greg in Europe? What are your observations and memories? And the guy who sent in something is, of course, Oscar Ossi Praxmacher, a good friend of yours. This is going to be in German for all the English-speaking listeners, so I'll do my best to summarize what's in the voice message. If you just want to skip it, fast forward, I think 2.5-3 minutes, and you'll get back to us talking about it. I'll try to deliver the gist of what Ossi Praxmacher has delivered, but let's just listen in and then dissect it.
Also, der Greg ist 1979 nach Innsbruck gekommen, als junger Wilder, dann von Deutschland einer, haben wir noch einen Freundschaftsspiel gehabt und dann ist er nach Innsbruck verpflichtet worden. Und hat natürlich kein Wort Deutsch kennen, nicht? Und haben wir dann natürlich eine mordsmäßige Show draus gemacht, um ihnen etwas Deutsch zu lernen, so wie zum Beispiel auch Katzenschwarf. Oder wir haben auch gesagt, er soll vorschreien zum Trainer, wenn man es auch nichts verstanden hat, der Paul Popil kein Wort verstanden hat. Ich wichse da auch nicht, dass mit der Arsch auf die Uhr schaut, das haben sie überhaupt nicht ausgebracht, die Kanadier. Also dann haben wir Mordshetz gehabt im Bus mit ihm, mit den Sprachkenntnissen. Und wie du weißt, er hat es bis heute nicht erlernt, Deutsch. Das muss ich vielleicht meine Schuld auch, weil ich war mit ihm viel am Weg und wir haben viel Englisch-Deutsch, so ein Mischmaß, wie er halt immer redet, haben wir eigentlich die letzten 40 Jahre immer so miteinander kommuniziert. Das war halt so. Der Greg war auch da, wie er gekommen ist, war wirklich ein junger Wilder, ist gekommen mit langen Haaren, hat ein Stirnband auf, hat keinen Helm aufgehabt beim Aufwärmen, ein Stirnband rum und war so richtiger Jungstar halt und hat sich wirklich feiern lassen und haben natürlich auch haben wir natürlich auch einige Abende verbracht, wo wir es auch lustig gehabt haben, ohne Frage. Unter anderem war unser Lieblingslokale von uns, das hat Philou geheißen, das war seine Nachtbar, und da hat es sogar die Rippeln gegeben. Und da sind auch der Greg und ich manchmal unter der Woche, wo wir auch keinen Alkohol getrunken haben, natürlich, haben wir es hingekocht, dann haben wir gesagt, ja, jetzt essen wir Rippeln gut, ist gesund, und dann trinken wir Ginger Ale dazu, und ja, und dann ist halt doch das ein oder andere Mal wieder die Frage kommen, sollte man nicht ein kleines Wermarsteiner trinken oder zwei? Und dann ist es halt oft einmal wieder sehr lustig geworden. Also das waren halt so Abende, die was wir gemeinsam verbracht haben im Filou und mit Essen, und aber nicht extrem, das muss ich auch sagen. Weil wir haben nachher immer wieder das gehabt, das war so ein Ritual von uns, wenn wir am Weg waren da und dort, haben wir in der Kabine drin nach dem Training immer noch schnell stoppen, starten gemacht, hat Greg mich motiviert, ich war ja doch noch jünger und kein guter Spieler, und da haben wir stoppen, starten gemacht, blaue zu blaue, und in der Kabine drin haben wir nachher gemacht 200, 300 Setups, da haben wir uns gegenseitig angefeiert, und ja, und so ist das eigentlich immer so ein bisschen ein Rivalitätskampf gewesen, und ist ja, wie soll ich sagen, notwendig gewesen, dass wir gut trainiert haben, und das war wirklich gut. Der Greg war immer sehr affin mit seinen Schlägern, das war sein Heiligtum, der hat immer 7, 8 Schläger hinten drinnen gehabt und einen, wo er 4 Buch reingetapt hat und immer technisch einmal angespielt hat, und die Schläger, die Sherwood-Schläger, was er gespielt hat, die waren wie Zündhölzeln, das sind viele abgebrochen, hat der Verein auch immer gejammert, dass er so viele Schläger braucht, aber er hat natürlich die Tore dafür geschossen und damit war das auch gerechtfertigt, und mit seinen Schlägern hat er auch ziemliches Geschiss, ich glaube, sagen wir mal so, aber berechtigterweise.
Again, loaded. First, you said that he's partly responsible for you still not being able to properly speak German. I strongly disagree. Just a little side note here. You're one of the very few players from back then who still to this day, I think, has good German, and it can say everything or anything that you want. He also talked about the social component and how you guys away from the ice maybe had a beer or two when maybe you should have had something else. But I guess that's how life worked back then too. And he also said that you were very peculiar with your sticks, that you broke not one too many, but a lot. And that, of course, raised some eyebrows within the organization because sticks were expensive, but you made it up by producing, scoring points, a lot of them. Let me just ask you about the foreign language aspect. You grew up with English and French as your native languages, and then a different beast rolls around, the German language. Not nice to the ear. Awfully hard to understand, to learn the grammar, the sound. How did you fare in trying to pick up this language?
Well, I never really thought about it, but one of the biggest things, if you want to learn something, like OC is right on the money. I come over with 72 sticks. I bring 6 dozen sticks with me, and I went through every one of them. And I had my heavy stick with the pucks. I'd stick at it with that, so I made my hands quicker and my sticks lighter. But he didn't tell the truth about we'd go to the flu all the time and we wouldn't drink. But then it would be, you want to have, why don't we just get a small one of those little Mickeys of Bacardi between us? Like that's just like 2 drinks each. Oh boy. That is the truth. Then we'd have 1 Mickey and another Mickey and whatever, and all hell would break loose. But we had so much fun. He is a very good friend. Back to what we were talking about, the German. They would tell me stuff all the time, right? We'd laugh. But the biggest thing is I wasn't shy to speak. And if I screwed up and it didn't matter, I just picked it up, like enough to get by probably my first year, I guess. But I remember a few years later, I took a couple of lessons with a private gal to all the dem, the das, the dies, holy Jesus. I said, let me just stick to my language and let me figure out as best I can. Not easy to learn, but I can't say I've mastered it. It's not like your English, but I get by, and I think my German kind of fits the TV commentary, which we do. So I guess I don't want to change that part.
I just want to briefly touch on the second year that you spent in Austria, the 79-80 season, because there's an instance, and you talked about your game in Klagenfurt with you scoring 4 goals, having a great debut there, loving the rink. There's an instance, and that's been shown by the stats that we dug up, where you scored 5 goals. in the season 79-80. Was that a regular occurrence, or do you remember your games where you scored 4 goals, 5 goals, maybe even 6 goals?
I remember a couple games I got 10 points, like 5 goals, 5 assists. Once was against Salzburg. I had a few pretty good games here and there. Yeah, but it was kind of fun. I didn't really think too much about it, but I did have a couple games where I had 10 points. I remember that.
Well, you couldn't have had 10 points in that game that I'm referring to. It was Kapfenberg against Innsbruck on October 27th in 1979. You had 5 goals. Innsbruck won 8-3. And I guess by then you were already on other teams' radars, on fans' radars. Word of mouth quickly, usually travels quickly. And people by then, I'm sure, knew how good you were. And then an interesting occurrence, it happens. You stay in Innsbruck for another year and you're joining forces with a good friend of yours, Lawrence Satcharuk joins Innsbruck. How did that all come about? How often did you talk about Innsbruck, and what made him join you in Innsbruck?
Well, he had been in Germany before. He was in Cologne. I'm not sure if he stayed the whole year, but he was in Cologne on that big team with Kunackel and all those guys. But I'm not sure if he finished the year then. Well, we talked about it, and they were looking for a defenseman. And I said, well, here's Satch. He got 35 goals that year, I think, at Innsbruck.
Second leading scorer on the team. 35 goals in 34 games as a defenseman.
Well, don't forget, he has the record to this day in Major Junior of scoring 50. He has that record till today. And he was the fifth to score 20 goals in the NHL at St. Louis. So for him to score 35 goals, he had the big shot. He had really stick handle. You could see the ice. For him to get 35 goals over there in 34 games was right up his alley. And of course, my sister was there too, so that was kind of nice, right?
There's something that happened in that 81-82 season where you joined forces at... Did I say 81, 82? No, I meant 80, 81. The 1 year you played together in Innsbruck. It's a story that's best told by Satch. And just to get ahead of ourselves a little bit here, he mentions a place called Wattens. He later got back to me and told me it didn't happen in Wattens. It happened in Mutters, which is a rural, suburban area around Innsbruck. But let's just listen to Satch tell that story, and then we'll talk about it later and see if you can remember it.
One time, Greg and I were coming home from a game in Innsbruck. I still remember it like it was yesterday. We lived in Wattens. We had a few beers after the game and didn't want the police to catch us. So we put our car on the railroad tracks and went all the way up the mountain and made it home safe. I don't think that's ever been done again.
Really? A car on railroad tracks just to evade the police?
Well, yeah, that probably sounds like right up my alley. And it was Mutters. Mutters is up above the Bergiesel ski jump. It's just up above there. Mutters, Ladders. I lived there for a bunch of years, met some great people, had some unbelievable times. A couple of car accidents, fire engines, the whole package going up and down those mountains. So that's another story in its own. Leaving the golf course at midnight and ended up upside down in the car, Alfa Romeo. Many crazy stories. But one time, me and Satch came home from a trip. We got home like 2 a.m. We're downtown. Well, let's go downtown. There's a couple of bars open. Let's go for a beer. So we had beers and ciggies going in the car. So we're taking off and we're driving downtown, sniffing around. Look, holy shit, there's the cops. the cops are going to, oh, they're following us, son of a bitch. So I make a couple deeks, right, left, cut, couple streets cut, and we pull in this parking lot and stop. Oh, Siggy going, beer going. Well, holy shit, who pulls up right beside us with the lights going? The freaking cops. We're in trouble, Satch. Anyway, the guy comes around, license. He looks at it, he goes, Greg Holst. Okay. You guys get home, man. See you later.
So you had made a name for yourself already.
You can't get away with that stuff anymore. No, but going up the tracks, I vaguely remember that now. Hey, that's a good story. I kind of forgot about that one.
There you go. See, it's also about bringing back some memories to you too. And thanks to Satch, there's one story that hopefully will remain with you for a little longer. You got to Innsbruck. You stayed in Innsbruck for 3 years, but after that, you changed teams and you went to Vienna. How come?
Word got out, Vienna was interested in me. I don't know how it came about. So Mr. Gruber was the boss there. And would you be interested? Good contract. This, I said, well, yeah, maybe we have to be here or whatever. We were still playing in the season towards the end. It was in the playoffs, but every year the playoffs changed, Martin. One year we had best of. Every year it changed. And if things would have stayed the same certain years, I would have won a couple times. No excuses. It's just I always seem to be fall short of the new system, which that's another story in its own. So Gruber flies me in. They fly me in during the week. And we sit down and he tells me, you know, here's what the contract's going to be. And we would like to buy you from Innsbruck, to have you as our player, to own you. I said, well, okay, well, I'm going to go back, finish the season, and let's see what happens. So anyway, Innsbruck did let me go. But what happened was I signed for, I think it was 40,000 US, so similar to what I made in Innsbruck. They had to pay. I understand. It was $500,000 or 400 or 40,000 US. It was a lot of money they had to pay to Innsbruck just that they could have me for the 1 year because they could not get me free. So I went to Vienna. I had a great year. Billy Gilligan was a player coach. We had Sakatch and net. We had Hiron, Schneider, big defenseman, Schuler, Steinbach. We had a really good team. And Gilly did a great job. So I had a really fun, great season in Vienna, but Innsbruck owned me and I had to go back after the season if we could come to an agreement.
And that agreement in itself, this will be a funny talking point, but I've got two or basically three things that I want to hit on in your Vienna season of 1981-82. You started the year, the campaign being on fire. The record show, you had 16 goals in six games. You had 24 goals after the first 10 games being played. Do you remember how hot as a scorer you were back then?
Oh, I was absolutely on fire. I thought I had 20 goals in eight games or something like that. And then what happened was I was getting hacked and chopped pretty good by the other teams because back then it was a lot of stick work and I was taking a bit of a licking. And I remember one of the first times ever, Gruber, the boss, came in the room and he kind of tied into the team because we had Steinbacher, Schuler, Schneider, big defenseman, tough. They said, you big freaking defenseman, you guys better start protecting Greg. I had never heard that before because I basically took care of myself. So that was music to my ears because I was taking a bit of a beating. So hot, we go into Kapfenberg and I have some guy following me around the ice, shadowing me, hacking, chopping. He wouldn't leave my side. And I go, okay, this is getting tough. So anyway, I didn't score in that game. I think it was 1-1 or whatever it was. It was really close. But this was brutal. The guy was just, you know, should have probably had a lot of penalties, but irrelevant. I come off the ice now. The fans are yapping at me and screaming. And of course, guy comes running at me. He was actually one of their functionaries. He started screaming at me and he came right up to me walking off the ice. So I'm going to protect myself. So I freaking belted him. I hit him with the right. Boom, a couple shots. There's a big pile up. Anyway, we leave. Well, don't I get called in? Gruber calls me in. He said, you've been sued by this guy. I had to go back to court in Kapfenberg. I drove down with Mr. Gruber. He was the lawyer. He said, Greg, just sit there. Don't be quiet. Don't go bananas. Just be quiet. Anyway, this guy takes us down. I'm not going to say his name. He started talking about his injury. This was like 4 or 5 days after the fact. Well, the judge said, well, what was your upper or lower lip? I can't quite remember. Really? Well, Greg stuck me with a stick. I said, no. He attacked me. Guys are coming at me. I hit him with a right or a left. I can't remember, with my glove on. And if he doesn't know what lip it is, and Gruber said, hey, Greg, settle down. So it was kind of a setup. It cost me back then 30,000 shilling fine, which is a lot of money back then. And I got a game suspension or 2-game suspension. I can't remember. That took the fire out of the whole situation a little bit. I still ended up getting quite a lot of goals, but I was on fire to start.
The record show, you got a 1-game suspension and you had to pay a 10,000 shilling fine, apparently. Maybe the
it was
the
30,000, I remember. 30,000, I think.
For the other other person's lawyer were added on top. That's
okay, yeah.
That's what might have brought it to 30,000. But
yeah,
that bullseye that you had on your back, there's an interesting newspaper article that I'd like to quote in German. I'll sum it up in English after that. Holst wurde systematisch fertig gemacht. Feldkirchs Coach Berek hatte Dorn, Conny Dorn, auf den Austro-Kanadier angesetzt. Durch pausenlose Provokation kam der Wiener Torjäger nicht in Fahrt und zum Leidwesen des WEV übersah der Schiedsrichter diese ständigen und unfairen Attacken. So you had a target on your back and Feldkirch, on its way to becoming a powerhouse for the first time in Austrian hockey, had a player named Conny Dorn and he was the one constantly hassling you, and obviously the referee didn't see his constant fouls against you, and I deliberately asked you a couple of weeks ago who the toughest opponent was or who the player was you hated going against the most, and Conny Dorn appeared to be right up there. Do you remember this one instance in your Vienna season, and whether other times where going up against Conny Dorn just wasn't fun?
Oh, no, this is nothing to do with tough. This is to do with dirty, like slashing and hacking. The gloves would never come off, which I wanted to. But no, it's when you play against, I played against some tough guys, some Fritz and Compain and even Peter Schibisti. Like those guys would hit me. And that's okay because they hit me fair. They didn't two-hand me and chop me and spear me and stuff. So Solzer was another guy. But don't forget back then, but Dorn was the worst. But Solzer also used to hack and duck because that was his job to get me off my game. And I have a good story about that. And I get along with Solzer fine today. Don't forget, that was allowed back then. And if you look at even when I coached, I feel like how the stick work was, Herbie and Stewie, it was tough and hacking. It was different. But there's a difference between being tough and being viciously dirty and not wanting to fight. And that's why you have to be careful. You know, Dorn had a couple instances too where he speared Jamie Masters right in the face. Right in the face. At home, you're probably getting a 2-year suspension. And so I see Conny now. We talk, how you doing? Boom, it's all forgotten. But it wasn't fun at the time because it wasn't fair. And the refereeing was not good. Like I said, Krenchrick was my favorite, but a lot of the refs, man, I remember one, we're time in Innsbruck, we're playing that team, full house, and the ref comes up to me and he says, "Hey, Holtz, I'm just letting you know, I'm the show tonight, not you." Okay, whatever. The good old days, eh?
What I'm sure was fun is being on fire and scoring seemingly at will. And to get that outside perspective, I once again have to go back to Lawrence, Larry, Satch, Satcharuk. Satch sent over this voice message about one instance that he vividly remembers, one game that immediately came back when thinking of it. Let's just listen in and then talk about it.
One of the years that Greg and I played together in Austria, I was playing for Stadlau, and he was playing for Vienna. I witnessed a hockey game where Greg, from the first period to the end of the third period, controlled the entire game. Not sure how many points he got, but was the best game I've ever seen any hockey player play anywhere, including any NHL, American Hockey League, I don't care where. He was as good as you could possibly be as a player.
Big words. Best game he's ever seen anyone play. Now, unfortunately, my notes don't feature that game, but you remember Vienna or your Viennese team against the other Viennese team from across the Danube, the derby game, where you apparently, according to Satch, played the best game he's ever seen?
Okay, yeah, that wasn't a game, though. That wasn't against them, because he was watching the game in the stands.
Okay.
I remember the game because he mentioned it to me after the fact, that I didn't even cross my mind. It was against Salzburg. It was Salzburg in Vienna. Satch was watching the game. And I vaguely remember because he talked about it. So I think what he really meant was I killed penalties. I played the power play. I had the puck. I won faceoffs. I hit. I scored. I did score if I remember correctly. Everything I kind of did changes. I just was one of those games that I was in control of the game. It's a very nice compliment for an established star hockey player like Satch to say that. It was a game against Salzburg. I remember playing that game. I obviously didn't view myself like that because I had, you know, some pretty good games in my career. But for him to watch it from above, you can see how somebody could control the pace of the game, control the puck possession, kill penalties, power play, all that stuff. So very nice compliment, much appreciated.
Still, what also eluded you in Vienna that year was that coveted championship. At the very end, all of us and all the hockey players out there are playing to win and playing to win a championship. But that didn't work. And the year after, you're returning to Innsbruck with a nice little wrinkle in your contract. First, did you ever think why is it me not being able to hoist a trophy at the very end of the season? And two, what efforts did Innsbruck make to get you back playing for him?
Well, can I make a quick comment on the Vienna situation first? Bill Gelligan was coach, player coach. We're at first place after 6 weeks or 2 months, whatever it was. I'm leading the league in scoring. Practices. We're having a great time. Sakac, the great goalie, is in nets. But the management figured they got to bring in a coach because it's too much for Bill Gelligan. It wasn't too much for Bill Gelligan. So they bring in Galanka, who was a great hockey player, a Czech, right? Czech hockey player. And he's going to coach us. So he might have been a great coach in his way, but he wasn't right for us. Because he tried to play some of the other guys that didn't play that much, maybe management's kids or whatever it was. We just were not the same. And I remember talking to Gilly, and the guy's like, why are they changing this? Like, we're in first place. So anyway, after whatever it was, I can't remember, month, 6 weeks, 2 months, Galaka left. It didn't work out. Gilly took over again. But we were behind the eight ball now. And with the system, how it ended up, we ended up finishing second. And never to this day knew why they made that change. It affected me. It affected all of us. So back, that is factual. So now I don't have much of a choice but to go back to Innsbruck, right? Or quit hockey. It's okay. They almost went to the second league. Their attendance was down big time. So they called me. We got together. I'm doing my own contracts now. Because me and Danny McCann, we made a settlement. I ended up paying them off some money. And we parted ways because there's no such thing as a life contract. We sit down. I say, well, guys, here's what I made in Vienna. So this is what you guys should pay me. Whether it was 40,000, yes, whatever it was. Which was, I think it was 40. Oh, no, we can't pay you that. Last year, not too many fans, whatever. I said, well, okay, well then. I won't play, which is fine. They said, but I said, I'll tell you what I do. How many fans did you have? They might have said 1,500 or 1,200, you know, way down from what we had the first 3 years before that. I said, okay. I'm thinking to myself, okay. Now, what happens, because I've done this before. Okay, what happens if I get a fan bonus? No, this is my first fan bonus in my contract. What happens if we get the same amount they had last year? Plus 500. So say we average 2,000. That would give me approximately 200,000 to 300,000 shillings. Well, 300,000 shillings, I can live with that. But what happens if we have a good year? Well, this could be interesting. So they didn't want to give me a car, apartment, or flight, which I ended up getting anyway. I said, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do. Your attendance is down. Boom. Give me 30% of the gate. So if we have X amount of fans, you guys make way more money than last year, and this is what I make. And they thought about it. I'm sure they talked about it behind closed doors. So they came back and said, yes, I had no salary, no fix-em. Reluctant on the flights to car. I got the car, I got the flight, and I got my apartment. And I got 30% of the gate. So who was on the team? Ron Kennedy, myself, Larry Skinner. Team's probably going to be okay. Early in the season, and the first, I don't know, second, third, whatever it was, you probably have the stat. We got in a fight, a bunch of us, and we all got suspended for a couple of games. And because the season started out, probably had like maybe 2,000 fans. And then we got suspended, and of course, attendance stays flat. I'm going, shit, we're not playing at home here, and I'm not making any money. But then we came back, we started playing good, and all of a sudden we had a couple 5,000 full houses. So I'm sitting on the bench going, hey, boys, beers are on me tonight. They had no idea what I was talking about because I was probably buying beers anyway. That season turned out to be pretty good. I made quite a bit of money, but I took a chance, right? Took a chance. So then when we negotiated the next year, I said, well, guys, give me the same contract. Oh, no, 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 we can't do that now. Well, I said, why? Because you're going to make too much money. I said, well, I took a chance because you guys were down in the dumps. So do it again. No, we can't. Okay. So we renegotiate something else, which still was pretty good for back then. I got it organized. That was a smart move by my agent. And that agent was me.
It's incredible. And just looking at some of the attendances, game number 13 that year against Färjestad, 6,500 people. Couple games later against Klagenfurt, another... an attendance of 7,500. So how did you feel coming out of the tunnel onto the ice and just watching the full stands knowing ka-ching?
One big smile on my face, buddy. But don't forget, Martin, I took a chance. So I was believing in myself that I could turn the team around. So I believed in my ability, and I knew what was before in Innsbruck. And if I could stick handle and make my moves and score some goals, and you're going to have the odd fight here and there, we could get this place buzzing again. Ron was great. Skinner was great. We had a really good team. We had a lot of fun. Crashy was coach. So it was great. But I had to believe in myself to even do this, in my ability to be able to turn the team around with the help of other players, of course. But it worked out. I took a chance, and it was a smart move.
There's two more things that I want to hit home in this part, and then still leave some meat on the bone as regards your playing career for part number four of 70 in 7. Players' salaries, and there was a bigger discussion going on apparently that summer because a lot of newspaper articles would suggest so. Nowadays are always kept secret, and back in the day, newspapers and journalists started to guess how much people were earning, and apparently Brian Stukiewicz made 900,000 shillings, Eddie Lebler 700,000 shillings, Jeff Geiger 800,000 shillings. Rumor had it that the Nashheims of this world made north of $1 million. You having your contract where you're getting part of the gates. How omnipresent was that discussion, or were the discussions of how much people were making, how much would be, or what to strive for in contract negotiations?
Well, I guess it was the player yourself and how talented you are. But don't forget, Mark, my second year in Innsbruck, I made 40,000 US. And back then, the dollar was 24 or 25 at its highest point. So in 1978, I made close to $1 million. But if I would have taken care of the $1 million as $1 million would be, that would have been smart. But I couldn't figure that part out with exchanges because I sent money home and did stuff, right? So the year that I did the 30%, if I remember back when, it was probably 880,900 around there. I think just under 900, which is a lot of money back then. And of course, don't forget, the guy's coming over, you get a flight, apartment, a car. That's a huge expense, a huge savings, right? Which young players now, I thought young players do contracts, and they never seem to figure that part in. It's always, I said, here, you're going to make 30, 40,000 euros. Well, I should make more than that. Okay, well, how much are you going to save? I could save this amount. Really? Okay, if you're playing in American Hockey League, make it 70,000, how much are you going to save? Nothing. Okay, so you're going to now save 35,000 Canadian. Is that a good deal? Holy shit, now that you mention it like that. And I've helped guys do contracts just like that. If you want to save 40,000 Canadians in Canada, you're going to have to make $120,000, $130,000 a year. And even then, you can't save that. So these young players I've helped, you're better to play 10 years saving 30, 40,000 cash than 1 or 2 years making more. So it's about a job. It's about how you organize your careers.
We're approaching or fast approaching your 30th birthday. You turned 30 years old in 1984. Another season, the 83-84 season that you spent in Innsbruck. An interesting one because the regular season had to be finished by mid-December. The playoffs had to be finished by mid-January to make space for the Winter Olympics in Sarajevo. You were on the squad. You were on Team Austria. You go to Sarajevo, But what unfolds next?
Imagine that, I'm going to the Olympics. Are you freaking kidding me? So we got a bunch of guys, and Stankiewicz and Greenbank and the boys, Petrix and Raffles and Harens. And we take the train down. This is great. We take the train down. It was almost no snow. So we're going, so like maybe 12 hours, 14-hour train ride, whatever. We stop halfway through, and we get off. And we're walking through this long alley with glass on both sides going into like a terminal or a restaurant. The place was packed with people pounding on the freaking windows. And we're going, hey, this is unbelievable. They want to see the hockey guys. No, no, no. They were all there to see Franz Klammer. And Franz Klammer went in by helicopter. He wasn't even on the freaking train. Well, we got a kick out of that. So we get to Sarajevo. There was no snow. And all of a sudden, the snow came. And we're talking record snow. So that this became beautiful. So the night before we're playing against Finland, I get word I can't play. I said, well, why can't I play? Because five guys, two from Team Canada, Jim Corsi, the goalie for Italy, Bjorn Skara. I remember Bjorn well. He was a great player, fast, played in Klagenfurt. He was with Norway and myself. We couldn't play. Disqualified because we had played games in the NHL. Pretty disheartening, but what are you going to do? So they did let me stay on. So I stayed on, watched a lot of the stuff. Brian Stankiewicz got hurt and missed a couple of practices. So Rudman was in nets, and who do you think gets the call to be backup goalie in practice?
Yours truly.
If you're looking at me, yes, yours truly. I got pictures putting on Brian Stankiewicz. He's helping me putting the freaking gear on. I am the goalie. This is a one time in a lifetime. This has never happened again. I'm in nets in practice. So I'm out there, and Rudy Kalius is the coach. And I know one thing I can do. I can play baseball. I can catch. The first drill he does, like it was a 3-on-0 from center ice. Well, Jesus Christ, Rudy, give me a couple of shots, will you? I got twisted around so freaking bad, I didn't know where my jockstrap was. Anyway, I was in practice a couple of games, and I remember one time, the guy from Cohol, or a stick guy, came. He was over on the bench. And I remember they told me after, he said, I think your backup goalie needs some new sticks. New sticks? I didn't need a new free position. But anyway, you know what happened? I bet a bunch of the guys, Cunningham and those guys, all those guys, they could stand 3-4 meters or 2 meters inside the blue line in a circle. They could fire pucks at me as hard as they want, slap shots. They will not score. Because I know what I could do. I could make that save with the skate the old way where you turn it out. And I could catch. I could catch every freaking puck because I'm a baseball player. We made bets. And if I remember right, I won a few beers from the boys. They couldn't score on those long shots.
But you see, hockey career is all about the highs and the lows. When we talk about the lows, and just the Olympics is a big deal for any athlete in any sport. You so much looking forward to being at the Olympics, and then a couple of days or a few hours away from hitting Olympic ice, you get told, can't play. How low was that low?
Well, it sure takes the fun out of all the preparation and everything, right? But I did stay on and watched a lot of the events. And then I was kind of hanging around with one of the Austrian ski gals, having some fun too with her, like just a friend. So it was fun following the guys. But of course, I was disappointed. But you know what happened the next Olympics? In 1988, was in Calgary, Canada. And now NHL players can play. You can play if you want. So I get a call from Bukach. He was the coach. They wanted me to go to Calgary to play the next Olympics. I said, no, I got a couple of kids. The season ends. I'm kind of beat up. I think, no. What a bonehead move that was. I could have played in Calgary at the freaking Olympics in my home country. And I turned it down. And you know who took my spot? Richard Grenier took my spot.
The year 1984 is not the last year, it's not the last time that we're going to talk about the year 1984 on this podcast, because it's also going to be the starting point on the next episode of 70 in 7 part 4, where we talk about your ages 31 to 40 and why 1984 is so important in that regard. How about that for a cliffhanger?
And boy, what a year 84, 85 was.
Coach, we hammered home a 135-minute episode, and we were just talking about 10 years of your life. And I guess we could have gone on for maybe double the amount of that. But for the time being, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so much for all the great stories, and already looking forward to talking to you next week here on 70 in 7, a Winter Day Hockey O'Clock original.
Martin, thank you very much. Great memories.
Winter Day Hockey O'Clock.
Kurz durchatmen bei diesem Wahnsinn. Und das ging rasend schnell. Der Traum vom Finale ist erfüllt. Mit mittendrin statt nur dabei. Mit Fans, stimmungsvoll und hoffnungsfroh. Nice move, another nice move. Oh, it's gone.